if not for the GI Bill. Henry Kissinger and Hank Greenberg reflect on the benefit that changed America, by Jeff Stauffer. Their Park Avenue offices are separated by just a few blocks. Each grew up in a modest household. Both served in the U.S. Army during World War II, European theater. One enlisted, the other was drafted. Each received the Bronze Star. Morris Hank Greenberg, after further service in the Korean War, led history's largest insurance and financial corporation, American International Group. Henry Kissinger, now an international consultant and best-selling author, famously guided the U.S. State Department through the dusk of Vietnam and into the long, slow thaw of the Cold War. They are friends. They go to work every day envisioning a bright future for America and the world. And they have something more in common. Both agree that if not for the GI Bill, drafted by the American Legion, the world would be a very different place. The American Legion magazine recently spoke with Kissinger, whose family fled Nazi Germany in 1938, and Greenberg, now chairman and CEO of C.V. Starr & Company, Incorporated, a global financial services firm, in their Manhattan offices. Describe your entry into U.S. military service and early impression of it. Kissinger. I worked in a shaving brush factory, and I went to City College at night, which was substantially free. I came to the United States and lived largely in a refugee environment. When I was drafted into the Army, after many different movements, I wound up in the 84th Infantry Division as a rifleman. The 84th Infantry Division came from northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, so I was surrounded there by what I would consider to be fundamental Americans and readily learned day-to-day living with Americans. Greenberg. I played football in high school, and getting gasoline to travel from one town to another to compete was cut off. So football season ended very early. The war was on. I couldn't wait to join. I was 17. I hitchhiked to Newburgh, New York, and walked into the enlistment office late in the afternoon, and they said, "Where are you going to stay tonight?" I said, "I don't know yet." They gave me a ticket to New York City to some hotel they had arranged. They said, "Your mother has to sign your enlistment papers." So I went outside, and I signed it. How did the Army influence you early? Greenberg. When the war ended, I was a tech sergeant. I was 19 and a half years old. That's 5 stripes, 1 below master sergeant. Pretty young. I could have gotten a field commission about 3 months before the war ended. I was in Patton's Army, 20th Corps, and if you got a field commission, you had to leave the platoon you were with and go elsewhere. I didn't want to leave the platoon I'd been with for months, so I refused that. Kissinger. In the military, you are who you are. It doesn't matter what you were before or after. In my life, one of the interesting things was that I had and still have, obviously, an accent. Some think it's a trademark, but I was very self-conscious about it. When I entered the Army, nobody ever asked me about my accent in the 3 and a half years I served. It wasn't until I got back to Harvard that the people started reminding me that I was foreign-born. So the Army was a great Americanizing experience for me. How did the GI Bill help you? Kissinger. Before the war, I could never have dreamt of going to one of the elite schools because I had to work. I was admitted to Harvard and got most of my higher education there, and it was the GI Bill that made that possible. Greenberg. I was interviewed by West Point after the war and told them I hadn't finished high school. They said they had a prep school I could go to first. I wasn't sure I wanted to start that low down after fighting through a war and being a tech sergeant. I took a commission in the reserves and came back, but I had to finish high school first, which was the hardest thing in my life at that time, going back to high school. I went to school in New York City, the Rhodes School. I got a room in New York on West 20th Street for $5 a week, way over toward the river. I didn't know anybody in New York City. It was a very lonely time. It took a lot of discipline not to go back to the Army right then. I was very tempted to go back, but decided to finish, and I did. And I went to college. The GI Bill paid for my high school, undergraduate, and law school. What was college like for veterans at that time? Kissinger. When I came to Harvard, I was ignorant of the procedures, so I applied in April of the year I wanted to go to Harvard, and you had to apply over a year ahead. They accepted me, but then it turned out they didn't have enough rooms. For the first 3 weeks, I had to sleep in beds in the gymnasium. I was 24 when I arrived at Harvard, and the typical freshmen were 17 or 18. Most of my friends in college were veterans because of the age difference. Greenberg. All the universities were jammed with vets. I got into the University of Miami. I knew some guys from my high school who were there, so I went. I started taking business school courses, and I found that boring. I went into pre-law and then took my first year of law school there. Since I wasn't going to practice down there, I transferred up to New York Law School and graduated. Then the Korean War broke out, and I was recalled almost right away. How did World War II veterans defy concerns that they wouldn't integrate well? Kissinger, veteran students at Harvard were outstanding. They were more disciplined. They had learned how to focus. They had more or less discovered who they were. Most freshmen, or many freshmen, were on a journey of self-discovery. That was natural for combat veterans. Greenberg, military experience rounded them out, made them different from what they were before. The discipline, the leadership skills. You have also been through a war, life or death experiences every day, so your outlook is much different. You mature very quickly, or you don't. Did it occur to you then that the GI Bill would have such a profound effect? Greenberg, I thought it would change me. I didn't think of the whole country then. I wasn't mature enough in that way. It had tremendous influence, and I recognize that now. Kissinger, I am afraid we took it for granted. Now I realize the enormous impact that the GI Bill had in those days. We sort of thought it was a benefit we were entitled to, but it was a very creative and original development. Later, I could appreciate the American Legion, not just for the GI Bill, but for keeping the spirit of comradeship alive and for the commitment to American defense, which is such an important characteristic. Do you think the GI Bill's grassroots origin contributed to its effectiveness? Kissinger, it certainly was an important factor in its long-term success, that it was done by people who wanted to make up, to some extent, for the years of service that veterans had given their country. They were focused directly on their immediate necessities. Greenberg, the number of men and women under arms during World War II was enormous. You couldn't just push them aside. And there was a feeling back home, I think, that we owed something to the people who fought the war. People back home were working in manufacturing, working at building aircraft, tanks, you name it. The whole country was at war, some in the active war, some on the home front. The whole country mobilized to thank those who did what they had to do. What made the GI Bill so effective? Kissinger, the success of the first GI Bill, judging by my own life, was that it was so uncomplicated. You did not have to submit a lot of bureaucratic material. You were not judged by various achievements. You were entitled to it as a veteran. If you flunked out, that was your problem. But it's one of the most, maybe the most, unbureaucratic benefits with which I am familiar, the automaticity with which you could form your life from being in the service to starting your education. Greenberg, a lot depends on the individual. You have access to education and the benefits you're entitled to, whether it's health care or whatever it may be, even pointing you in the right direction for a job with some help from the government. But a lot of it you have to do yourself. You can't become a slave to government assistance. You are trained to be self-reliant. You have educational benefits, but you have to use them. You can't sit back and say, "What else am I entitled to?" You're trained. Take advantage of it. What did the GI Bill do for America? Greenberg, it put us on a growth course. It took a bunch of young men and women and helped them get an education. They were all motivated. They were proud of their country. They were proud of what they had done. They sparked growth that never would have happened. The country as a whole benefited. Yes, we had to rebuild parts of the world afterwards, which created great opportunities. We knew how to manufacture. We knew how to train people. I wouldn't have had the same responsibilities at 19 years old in normal civilian life. At 19, I was 25 mentally. Kissinger, the big challenge for America at the end of the war was to reintegrate the millions who had interrupted their lives to serve their country, and secondly, to attest American policy to a world in which we could no longer be isolated. So the GI Bill performed two functions, at least. One, it enabled returning veterans to define a trajectory for themselves, supported by their country. And secondly, it enabled the country, on the basis of this reservoir of people who had been educated both in the war and then in the GI Bill, to perform a responsible international role. What might have become of each of you professionally if not for the GI Bill? Greenberg, hard to say. I'd have done something. I might have played professional football. Kissinger, if not for the GI Bill, I might have become a partner in an accounting firm, which is what I was studying before I was drafted. What might have become of the United States if not for the GI Bill? Kissinger, America without the GI Bill might have become a very divided country. Millions of people would have had to find an occupation and an education, above all, on their own. And the consciousness that the country was taking care of us was such an important element. In my case, I know that when I left the service, I could go to college and never have to think 5 minutes about how I was going to pay for it. The war involved America in the world, but the fact that our people could educate themselves about the necessities of great power existence was an important element. Before the war, we were essentially an isolationist country. After the war, we became more and more involved in world affairs as we developed an educated citizenry that shaped that relationship. Greenberg, there is no question what the GI Bill did to transition from the war to civilian life and to the economy as a whole. It changed America, really, over a period of a few years. You had this influx of people coming back, going to school, getting married, raising families. It made the transition possible. It made the growth of the economy possible. It provided fuel for the economy, and it worked better than anybody thought it would work. Why hasn't it been copied? We should. What about the vets coming home today? Why shouldn't they have that benefit? Who deserves it more? I think we owe the current group of veterans more than they are getting. Clearly, many Americans, men and women who served in the military forces during World War II, were eligible for the GI Bill to further their education in one way or another. Like all students, you had to meet certain standards and maintain them, but it opened the door and was an opportunity for millions who otherwise would never have thought of pursuing higher education. Following their education, new economic opportunities presented themselves, better jobs with a brighter future than they would have had to look forward to. It also prepared them to start businesses of their own following their college education, and it was easier for them to raise money to start a new business. It made a generation of Americans more confident in themselves to achieve economic success and change the economic growth of the United States. Better educated Americans became a catalyst for economic growth in the country that would never have taken place. Legion's Salute to the GI Bill exhibit opening at National World War II Museum. The National World War II Museum in New Orleans presents The Greatest Legislation, an American Legion's Centennial Salute to the GI Bill, an exhibit opening June 20th. In addition to illustrated panels and videos, also displayed will be original signed pages of the actual Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, on loan from the National Archives, a pen used by President Franklin D. Roosevelt to sign the historic legislation, and Roosevelt's original speech announcing its passage into law after months of tireless effort and lobbying by the American Legion. To open the exhibit, an admission-free reception, panel discussion, and forum led by American Legion 100th Anniversary Honorary Committee Chairman Ted Roosevelt IV is scheduled at the museum on June 20th. Activities begin at 5 p.m. and continue until 7:30 p.m. Scheduled speakers include author and former U.S. Senator James Webb of Virginia, architect and champion of the post-9/11 GI Bill, American Legion Executive Director Verna Jones, student veterans of America President and CEO Jared Lyon, John Kamen, the Legion's Assistant Director of Veterans Employment and Education, and a VA representative. Video presentations on the GI Bill's influence within the display include interviews with former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, international business leader Hank Greenberg, USAA Chairman and retired Air Force General Lester Lyles, American Legion Department of Missouri Adjutant Lowry Finley Jackson, and descendants of Harry W. Comrie, the American Legion past National Commander, who assembled what would become the GI Bill in longhand in the winter of 1943 to 1944. Those interested in attending the free reception, forum, and opening can reserve online at www.nationalww2museum.org or call 1-877-813-3329, extension 412. Levittown and the Birth of Suburbia. At the peak of construction in 1948, 36 homes were started and finished in one day. In all, between 1947 and 1951, 17,447 houses arose from the Island Trees pasture land, later renamed Levittown, New York, to accommodate the surge of World War II veterans using their GI Bill benefits to restart their lives. The average age of a Levittown home buyer at the time was 23. Within 48 hours, you could go from a cement slab to a house you could move into, says Paul Manton, president of the Levittown Historical Society, which operates a museum to honor America's prototypical subdivision inside the Levittown Memorial Education Center. In 1950, a Time magazine cover story put it this way, "For sale, a new way of life." The first homes, which sold for $7,900 each, came with Bendix washing machines and General Electric refrigerators and ranges. The 1950 models had built-in Admiral televisions. It was about transition from radio to TV, from traditional culture to pop culture, Manton says. Brothers Alfred and William Levitt, a Navy CB during World War II, masterminded the project. They had landed a contract to build row houses for shipbuilders in Norfolk, Virginia, and employed assembly line mass production processes to meet the Navy's needs. They would later develop subdivisions in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, and Puerto Rico to meet massive post-war housing demand. The Levittown Historical Society Museum is open Wednesday afternoons and Friday evenings, free of admission. Warren Atherton and the Power of a Team. When Warren Atherton of Stockton, California, was elected National Commander of the American Legion in 1943, hundreds of propositions had been made to help newly discharged veterans of World War II, many disabled, who were returning home at a clip of about 75,000 per month. Few of those proposals became law or even policy. The U.S. government was not prepared for such a surge of veterans in need. VA health care was in its infancy. The disability claims process was bogged down. Education and career opportunities were almost nil for those who came home, changed by wartime experience, many of whom had suspended their educations and careers to serve in uniform. On the eve of his election to lead the nation's largest veterans organization, Atherton announced that home and business loans for returning veterans, along with education aid, would be the principal objective of his term. He quickly appointed a special committee of top Legionnaires with former Illinois Lieutenant Governor John Stelly, a future American Legion National Commander, as chairman. The committee's tasks were to prepare a clear omnibus bill and campaign for its adoption. 8 months later, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, the GI Bill of Rights, was signed into law, and the country was on its way to over a half century of prosperity and growth. American Legion past National Commander Harry W. Calmery often gets credit as the author of the original GI Bill because he distilled in longhand the multiple initiatives into one 10-plank platform, working night and day in his room at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. in the winter of 1943 and 1944. Atherton and Calmery both, however, would correct any attribution of credit to one person. The bill and its effects proved bigger than any individual. Many members of Congress worked closely with the Legion to bring the measure to life. Senator Ernest McFarland of Arizona, who was actively involved with many veterans organizations, drummed up support for it on Capitol Hill. U.S. Representative Edith Norse Rogers of Massachusetts helped write and co-sponsor the legislation and has been called the mother of the GI Bill for her contributions. She was among the veterans who stood behind President Roosevelt when he signed the Landmark Act on June 22, 1944. Atherton applied his military and business background to assemble a team that would not just talk about the problem, but solve it. An army captain in France during World War I, he returned home to California and married Anne Holt, daughter of Benjamin Holt, founder of Caterpillar Incorporated. Atherton began a law practice there and was later widely respected as a Stockton City judge and president of the Chamber of Commerce. Atherton also later worked as general counsel for the California Department of Veterans Affairs and as a consultant to the U.S. Secretary of War. The University of the Pacific Library in Stockton houses the Holt Atherton Department of Special Collections, where many correspondences pertaining to the GI Bill and the American Legion's efforts to make it a reality can be found. The papers also contain clippings, scrapbooks, photographs, and memorabilia that amplify his continuous effort to keep the GI Bill remembered as a team achievement. Atherton was often asked to record the efforts of exceptional Legionnaires who contributed to its passage. The American Legion's fight to adopt was an all-time demonstration of the power of a team fighting every inch of the way to reach their goal, he wrote at the GI Bill's birth. The nationwide support of every post and every unit of the auxiliary was outstanding. The support of the American people was enthusiastic. The cooperation of Congress was all that representatives of American citizenry could give. The special committees included Stelly, who served as chairman, past National Commander Colmery of Topeka, Kansas, W.B. Waldrip, a prominent banker and member of the American Legion's Rehabilitation Commission, Robert Sisson, chairman of the Rehabilitation Commission, National Legislative Commission chairman Morris Devine, Robert M. McCurdy of California, who later became Pasadena's city manager, Sam Rorex, federal district attorney for Arkansas, and others. These men were the ball carriers, Atherton said. They took advantage of openings made by the line. They followed the determined blockers who knocked out opposition. They were the ground gainers who finally carried our ball over the line. American Legion Department commanders, service officers, and state committees also worked tirelessly on the campaign at the local level. They called upon their congressional delegations in Washington and at home and worked with the media to fuel overwhelming public demand for speedy enactment of the bill. The press, particularly newspapers published by William Randolph Hearst, largely supported the Legion's efforts to help veterans of World War II. Once passed and put into service, the measure ultimately produced millions of college graduates, including scientists, engineers, doctors, and educators, who Atherton would later describe as the backbone of our national security. The incentive of free college tuition ultimately became so attractive that the United States could go more than 40 years and continuing without a draft. Successor bills were passed for veterans of the Korean War, the Cold War, the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and, in 2009, those who had served in the War on Terrorism. By the time the post-9/11 GI Bill was passed and enacted, the most common argument was that none of the successor bills matched the 1944 original. As the significance of the first GI Bill grew more obvious in the mid-1960s, and most of its creators were still alive to discuss it, many requests came to record the story of its passage, including a 1966 resolution from the Department of California to the Legion's National Internal Affairs Commission for an official history of the battle to get it passed. Also at that time, an Indiana University student, the Reverend Lyle P. Murphy, had worked with the American Legion National Headquarters Library to prepare a seminar paper titled The Enactment of the GI Bill of Rights. It was obtained and distributed throughout the organization. In a letter dated September 8, 1966, to American Legion Department of California Commander Ed Sharkley, regarding a resolution to specifically commend Stelly and Atherton on the GI Bill, Atherton wrote, "I agree with Harry Colmery that the whole matter should be initiated on an impartial basis, not emphasizing the contribution of any individual." Personal letters in the Atherton papers include correspondences among members of the special committee to ensure that no individual receives more credit than the group as a whole. In 1968, American Legion National Librarian Thomas V. Hull gathered the congressional documents, hearing transcriptions, and other records to put the story together and show that the GI Bill was not about individuals, but a massive testament to the power of mutual helpfulness, as stated in the preamble to the American Legion Constitution. At the same time, University of Maryland history professor Keith W. Olson was in the Legion Library researching for a study titled The GI Bill of Rights and Its Relationship to Higher Education. The Mayflower Hotel Suite in Washington is recognized as the place where Colmery assembled the bill, but Atherton later added that, "At all times during the campaign, the national headquarters of the American Legion at 1608 K Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., remained the headquarters of the judge advocate, the GI Bill Committee, and myself as national commander when appearing before Congress." Atherton also explained the decisions of the committee, after his approval, were advanced for review to acting national judge advocate Francis Sullivan with directions to prepare legislation for submission to Congress. Sullivan later reported that he had prepared it with the assistance of a congressional bill writer and delivered it to Stelly, the special committee chairman. In January 1944, the measure was introduced in the Senate by Bennett Champ Clark of Missouri and in the House of Representatives with numerous co-signers. About halfway through the campaign and after some hearings, there were requests for changes and amendments by members of both houses and our committee, Atherton wrote. The entire bill was rewritten by congressional bill writers, including the changes, most or all of which were concurred by the GI Bill Committee. Atherton requested that, when Comrie received the American Legion's Distinguished Service Medal in 1975 for his lifetime of service, that he might have the privilege of seconding the motion and take the opportunity to name a few of the other leaders on the GI Bill Committee. John Stelly, in particular, spent most of 5 months in Washington at his own expense working for the bill. Senator Clark, the then senators from Illinois, Les Ahrens and Mrs. Rogers, Lawrence Smith and Eleanor Smith, president of the auxiliary, should be included. Atherton said Comrie could surely name others whose contributions were essential, but the list would be endless. However, with your help, Atherton wrote to Comrie, I think we can agree upon a few of the very outstanding persons both in and out of the Legion, without whose assistance the GI Bill, as we know it, might have failed. Comrie made it clear in his letter to Atherton that uppermost was to give credit to others. A picture taken at the Mayflower Hotel quotes Comrie in the caption saying, "This was not the work of one man, but more properly, what a dedicated group accomplished under the leadership of Warren Atherton." Both past national commanders used the spotlight cast upon themselves over the GI Bill to deliver a greater message about the American Legion on the power of teamwork. Michael Hjelmsted. GI Bill remains a work in progress today. Historians David Whitman and Suzanne Mettler have studied the GI Bill and the way in which it has been used, and in some instances abused, since its passage in 1944. Some issues in the administration of benefits have proven cyclical over the decades, they explained at a roundtable discussion recently hosted by the American Legion's Veterans Employment and Education Division in Washington. Many lawmakers make a big mistake in thinking that today's veterans' issues are something new under the sun, Whitman said. To a surprising degree, policymakers struggle today with many of the same issues in designing educational benefits for veterans that Congress and VA struggled with after World War II. Mettler said the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944 transformed post-war America by providing multiple opportunities for veterans. They in turn emerged as civic and political leaders in communities nationwide. Those opportunities and effects, however, have occasionally given rise to abuse. Through the GI Bill, American society recognizes the immense sacrifices that those in the armed forces make on behalf of the nation and aims to provide veterans with assistance in readjusting to civilian life, Mettler said. So that the law's purpose can be realized, lawmakers need to ensure that veterans and taxpayers are not taken advantage of by those who find business opportunities in the federal dollars provided by the GI Bill. Whitman said two patterns stand out. First, there are the myths, or perhaps misconceptions, about the GI Bill. Second is the cyclical nature of controversies over education benefits for service members. Ever since the first GI Bill, a pattern has repeated itself, Mettler said. The federal government makes new funds available for education, and actors in the proprietary sector find ways to take advantage of them, and problems of fraud and abuse ensue. Eventually, scandals emerge, and the media exposes them. In time, lawmakers come together across the aisle to create reforms so that such problems are alleviated or scaled back. Then the cycle repeats itself. The original GI Bill, according to Whitman, sent millions of former GIs to college. But what is less known is that many more World War II veterans used these benefits to attend private trade schools, some of which were ineffective. Proprietary schools or for-profit trade schools opened at an astonishing rate in response to the new government provision of tuition payments for GIs, Whitman said. In one 18-month stint after the war, 4 proprietary schools a day opened in the United States. Unfortunately, many of the new trade schools used deceptive advertising, made misleading promises to GIs about future careers and job placement, and engaged in a variety of fraudulent practices that bilked the government out of taxpayer dollars and wasted veterans' educational benefits. As was the case for the original GI Bill, the post-9/11 version has produced its own investigations of predatory practices by schools that did not put purpose ahead of profit. Most recently, the post-9/11 GI Bill was a marvelous legislative accomplishment, but its implementation has been partially marred by schools in the proprietary sector, Mettler said. The issue is not genuinely ideological. The question is simply, who will stand up first and foremost for veterans? The American public, across party lines, supports aid to veterans. Lawmakers would do well to find common ground on this issue and to seek reform. Currently, one in four students using the post-9/11 GI Bill attends proprietary schools, many of which have poor records in serving students, Mettler added. If these problems are not addressed, they may eventually endanger the entire law. The Legion's voice needs to be heard, both in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country, with members communicating their concerns to their senators and representatives. The record of the proprietary sector should be of utmost concern. The GI Bill and its versions over the decades have always been a work in progress, ever in need of adjustments and oversight, which the American Legion has consistently provided. The Legion has played an important role in the development of every GI Bill, Whitman said. That's a testament to the Legion's recognition that education is the most surefire way for veterans to better their lives and advance their careers. The American Legion works continuously to improve and protect the GI Bill. Today, the Legion's Veterans Employment and Education Commission, National Security Commission, and service officers, for example, are working to strengthen protections for students whose colleges close. For-profit school closures such as ITT Technical Institute and West Tech College in California cost credits and GI Bill benefits for veterans. The American Legion supports H.R. 1216, the Protecting Veterans from School Closures Act of 2017. GI Bill funding for business startups. The American Legion supports, by resolution, expansion of GI Bill benefits to provide startup capital for veteran-owned businesses. The 1944 GI Bill helped fund hundreds of thousands of farms and businesses, and post-9/11 veterans are statistically proving to be successful entrepreneurs when given the opportunity. Discharge review. The American Legion provides staff experts to assist those who dispute the definitions of their discharges or wish to correct military records. Discharge review was introduced in the 1944 GI Bill, and American Legion representation has long been provided under the National Security Commission's leadership.